Okay, yeah, we are pleased to see so many people joining the seminar today. Welcome, everyone. We would like this continuation of exploring the cross-disciplinary topics and technology at 3xFL for fundamental searches. So we'd like to welcome today, give a warm welcome to our colleague from CLF, Jack Halliday.
Thank you very much. I want to start by kind of introducing myself and saying I'm a staff scientist here at the lab. I'm also a plasma physicist. And so for me, a lot of the physics that I'm talking about today is actually stuff that I'm quite new to. So I guess bear that in mind in terms of the introduction. Please bear with me in those places. This is a project that I started when I was a postdoc at the University of Oxford in the group of John Mikhagori, but I continue to collaborate with, along with Bob Bingham here at the lab. You might also see from the PPD side a few familiar names at the bottom of the authors list. In particular, Ian Shipsey, Solimist, who sort of was involved in the conception of this work, and Subir Sarkar, who I think might be a name that a few people are aware of as well. In terms of an overview of what I'm going to discuss, I'll begin by introducing axions and axion-like particles and giving an overview of how people look for them. I'll talk through the experimental design for this particular search. And I'll run through some experimental data from some initial work on the European free electron laser. I'll touch briefly on a follow-up experiment that we performed actually just last year in October at SACLA in Japan, but the analysis is still ongoing for that, so it's going to be quite brief. And then at the very end, I will switch gears and use the first four bullet points to motivate some ideas about fundamental physics with high-powered lasers. So in terms of an introduction, axions are a hypothetical particle, not included in the standard model, which solves the strong CP or charge parity problem and are a cold dark matter candidate. So these are things that are initially postulated to explain the absence of charge parity violation in strong interactions. We know this is a conserved quantity because otherwise there would be a neutron dipole moment which constrain this to be small experimentally. It arises from a spontaneous breaking of PQ symmetry. And on the right-hand side, you can kind of see a bounds plot, which is like a map of this field. Sorry for PPD colleagues, this might be a bit low level, but I can see a few faces from different departments in the audience, so I'll kind of explain what this actually is. The x-axis of this plot is the axion mass. This kind of encodes the energy scale associated with an interaction involving an axion. The y-axis is the axion photon coupling, so this tells you something about the probability of producing an axion in an interaction of two photons. And drawn on this plot are areas of exclusion. So these are regions where people have looked by various different means and they haven't found any axions. And the way that you make progress in this field is you go and look somewhere, and if you don't find anything, you draw a new area on this diagram. And then if enough people look in a place they don't find anything, then I guess eventually people will just stop looking there. Another thing to notice on this diagram is this vertical or diagonal bands running through it, labeled the QCD axion band. And that's because in QCD, axions follow this defined scaling. But string theory predicts axion-like particles are out, so these kind of appear anywhere on experimental space. In terms of a bit of history, in this field, people have typically seen light axions with masses of around a micro eV as a natural dark matter candidate. And laboratory searches have traditionally targeted this light axion window. A motivation for the study that I'm talking about today is some theoretical interest in heavier axions, which comes about through a recent suggestion that if PQ symmetry is broken after inflation, so you tweak the cosmological time frames, then axions would also be produced in the decay of so-called domain walls. And taking this initial contribution into account, shifts the favored mass scale for axions to be dark matter above 10 to the minus 2 eV. So I can't go into much more detail about that, but this paper here by Subir is a good place to start, I think, if you want to kind of see more about that sort of theoretical motivation for this stuff. In terms of the lay of the land when it comes to search strategies, there are a variety of complementary methods to look for axions within this field. And these range from the astrophysical to lab detection, to lab generation. Astrophysical bands are shown on the plot on the right-hand side in blue. These involve things like introducing axion loss terms to stellar models and seeing when they start to break down. Lab detection models are shown in red and purple. And these are techniques where you look for axions which are produced from, say, the sun or some astrophysical source, but you try and look for a signature of them in the lab. At the very bottom of the scale, you have lab generation experiments. These are techniques where you seek to both generate and possibly detect axions terrestrially. And I think the way that I certainly see this field is these things exist complementary to one another, in the sense that astrophysical bounds are by far and away the most sensitive, but lab bounds have the lowest model dependence. So it's worthwhile using all these different techniques to look for axions if you want to make some progress in other fields. I'm going to run through some examples of different axion search strategies. And the first couple of these will be what I called lab detection experiments. So these are where we look for axions produced elsewhere with some terrestrial apparatus. And in the first case, we're talking about CAST, or the CERN Axion Telescope. This is a so-called helioscope, in the sense it looks for axions produced in the sun. And the way that it does this is through something called the Primakov effect. And you can understand that through this interaction with Lagrangian for the axion photon that you see here. And what this tells you is that if you have parallel electromagnetic fields, and there is some probability to generate an axion, or by the inverse process, if you have a strong magnetic field and an axion, at some probability you'll generate a photon. And that's exactly how this thing you see on the right-hand side here works. This is effectively an electromagnet, that's a blue thing, and it's arranged on some rig that looks like a telescope so that it can trace the path of the sun in the sky for something like an hour a day. And if during that time an axion propagates down the bore of the magnet, there's some probability it generates an axion. And you detect this with an optical detector at the bottom of the magnet. So this is great in the sense that you have very compressive bounds, you see in red at the bottom there. But the geometry of the setup suppresses sensitivity to axions above an EV. So for this heavy axion window that I motivated earlier, this is currently not a useful strategy. There have also been people who've argued that model dependence associated with the high temperature and finite plasma frequency in solar plasma might suppress axion production, and so these bounds therefore carry a degree of model dependence. Another example of one of these lab detection experiments is ADMX. This is a helioscope that looks for axions from the local galactic halo, and the idea is you have a microwave cavity surrounded by superconducting electromagnets, and you tune the Q factor of that cavity to scan through different axion masses. You can see the bounds plot for this particular experiment at the bottom here, and it's got very impressive sensitivity down to QCD relevant couplings for this light axion. So those are a couple of examples of detection experiments. I'll discuss now a couple of generation experiments. The first and possibly the most famous of these is a so-called light shining through a wall scheme. And the motivation for this, right, the express motivation, was that generating any axion in the lab removes model dependence from the generation mechanism. You can see a diagram of the scheme here. Sorry, I'm not going to use a pointer because I'll just end up screwing up. It effectively consists of an optical laser which passes down the bore of an electromagnet. And again, through the Primakov effect, there's some probability that you generate an axion through the electric field of that photon and the magnetic field of the magnet. These axions propagate along the same path as the laser, and somewhere in the setup there's an opaque wall. The laser's blocked, but the axions don't care, they go straight through. And there's some probability that in a second segment of the electromagnet, through the inverse process, photons are regenerated and you detect these. So you reduce model dependence, but you suppress your sensitivity, right? Because there's a generation and a regeneration process, or reconversion process, you suppress the sensitivity by a factor that goes to something like the coupling tensor, which is quite a small number. For this optical scheme, you're not sensitive to the high masses that, again, I motivated earlier, because you're using visible photons. Another example of a lab generation experiment is a so-called vacuum birefringence scheme. And the idea here is that you look for induced electricity in a laser that propagates through a magnetic field due to some interaction with the vacuum. This is sensitive to the QED effect, that was the original motivation.
But axion-proton coupling can also introduce some electricity here. So if I guess for CLF colleagues, this is like doing parallel rotation on the vacuum. You're sensitive to the generation of axions, but not the regeneration of photons, so you don't have that suppression factor I mentioned previously, but there's a hard limit on the overall sensitivity, because at some point the QED effects come in and those will send a signal. So that was maybe a bit whirlwind, but that was kind of my broad overview of the field as I've seen it, at least. The next thing I want to discuss is exactly how the scheme that I'm talking about works. And the motivation of this scheme is effectively to take that optical light sharing through a wall experiment and extend it up to X-ray energies. So again, we rely on the Primakov effect. But in this case, we have an X-ray laser. And I think for the purpose of this talk, you can just view the X-ray laser as a coherent source of plane waves that are in the X-ray energy range. And we have those impinge on this double crystal setup that you can see here. So you've got those plane waves impinging on the crystal. They have a defined polarization, which is directed up, down in the diagram. And then you have your crystal. And we diffract off crystal planes that are perpendicular to the surface of the crystal to create this path for photons that you see here. The electric field comes from the interatomic field between the lattice planes in the crystal. So this field is very strong. It's on the order of 10 to 11 volts per meter. The equivalent magnetic field will be a kilotesla. So for the half millimeter of germanium crystal that we use for EUXFL, we get a path integrated field, which is equivalent to 25 tesla meters, which is about as good as you can access with the best electromagnets. The way the scheme works, I should say, is effectively you generate axions in the first crystal. These co-propagate with the photons to the shield. Again, the shield blocks the X-rays, the axions they can, they propagate straight through. And in the second crystal, they reconvert to photons, X-ray photons in this case, which you detect down to through. This work builds on previous experiments performed on a synchrotron by Imagiel, but the studies that I'm talking about were the first to use X-ray lasers to do this kind of process. You can see at the bottom here a picture of the setup. There's your generation crystal and your reconversion crystal, and the shield will sit somewhere between them. The overall spatial scale of it is very much tabletop. It's 4 centimeters, 5 centimeters or so. But that's a bit misleading because, of course, in order to generate the X-rays, you need a big old linear accelerator. So for those of you that aren't aware, an X-FEL is an X-ray light source based on an electron linear. You need about 10 GeV electrons, and these are directed through what are called undulators, which are essentially periodic dipole magnets that cause the electron beam to oscillate, emitting radiation. And through a process which is called SASE, or self-amplified spontaneous emission, the emitted radiation interacts with the electrons, causing microbunching. The microbunching amplifies the light, so you end up with this coherent emission process, and it's characterized by very short pulse durations on the order of 10 femtoseconds or so. You can add to this kind of scheme something called self-seeding. And the idea here is that you put an X-ray monochromator in the beam, as shown just here. The monochromator only lets X-rays of a certain energy through. So you impose a preferred length scale on the micro bunches and you end up with, broadly speaking, monochromatic light, as you see here. People talk about the quality of these instruments in terms of a unit which uses the name brilliant, which is a bit of a strange one, but effectively this just says lots of photons per second per unit area, per unit angle, per 1% of bandwidth. So lots of photons at one color, at one time in one space. These are high impact science machines, which are used for things from drug discovery to fundamental physics. And the way that you get time on them is you bid for access in really quite competitive pools. So we used a configuration at the European Free Electron Laser, in particular the HED or HiBEF instrument, and we got 3 days. So that's 72 straight hours, 24 hours a day. A beam time awarded over the Easter bank holiday in 2023. We operate the instrument in a self-seeded mode. The photon or the X-ray parameters are shown here. I think probably the key ones to note for this discussion are that it was about 10 kiloelectron volt photons, and the pulse duration is really quite short, on the order of 10 femtoseconds or so. The instrumentation which you have available for you at HED is useful in the sense that it allows you to place constraints on input, output,
input and output X-ray flux in absolute terms. So you can see a kind of a cartoon of the overall instrumentation that was installed here. You've got the incoming X-ray beam from the left-hand side, and this is directed through an X-ray gas monitor, which is a passive measure of energy per pulse impinging on our crystal setup that you see here. The crystal setup for EU Expo was immersed in a 2-meter scale vacuum chamber. That's this thing you see here. And any regenerated photons that we might create through axions were made to propagate through these baffles into a 6-meter scale flight tube. So this was just an evacuated tube to reduce background onto a hybrid pixel detector called a Jungfrau 4, which was the primary detector for this scheme of work. This slide's a bit dense. I'm sorry about that. It's very quite difficult to condense this to less information than I've got here. And what you see here are a couple of equations that encode the probability of axion conversion and the mass range for a search for axions. If we look at the probability equation, first of all, you can see that the probability, of course, depends on the coupling constant, the effective electric field within the crystals, and then the length scale associated with photons propagating through the crystal, and then the cosine of the bright angle. So looking at these equations, this equation here, I think the key thing to pull out of it is the majority of the terms in this equation you have no control over. These are just aspects of the solid state physics that it takes the diffraction through the crystal. The one thing that as an experimentalist you can tune is the crystal thickness. And so that's our one dial we have to drive up the sensitivity as far as possible. The second set of equations encodes the mass range for a search. So an interesting aspect of this double crystal monochromator type axion detection instrument is the fact that you're sensitive to two different sorts of mass range depending on how you set it up. In the first instance, if you set both crystals to their Bragg angle, you're sensitive to a broad range of axion masses, which is set by M gamma, which is the plasma frequency of the valence electrons within the crystal. So again, just some solid state physics effects, and also K gamma, which is the photon energy. So this will give you a broadband sensitivity with some cutoff that just depends on the plasma frequency of your valence electrons, after which you're not going to get generation. If you detune both crystals by an equal amount from the Bragg angle, though, you end up in the regime which is encoded by this equation here, where you're sensitive to a narrow band of axion masses, which is increases in proportion to the square root of the detuning angle. And in the work that I'm discussing here, we'll exploit both of these regimes, both the broadband on Bragg search and the off-Bragg narrowband search regimes. This, again, I think might be targeted more towards colleagues that are used to X-ray light source work. But a question that you often get asked when you present this kind of stuff is, why do we opt for this esoteric Laue geometry diffraction regime? And in this Laue regime, we scatter off lattice planes that are normal to the crystal surface, as shown here. And due to an effect called the Bormann effect, we get anomalous extinction within the crystals. So the photons can propagate quite a long way before they're absorbed compared to the conventional mass attenuation. If you compare that to the Bragg diffraction case, where you scatter off planes parallel to the crystal surface, then you end up losing all your photons. They get diffracted essentially within a very short length scale. So just by swift swapping to this Laue geometry, you end up in a regime where you increase your sensitivity quite dramatically. I should say actually that this figure here, this was the original proposal for an X-ray based axion light shining through a wall experiment from a fellow called Buchmeller. And Buchmeller, as a kind of a weird throwaway paragraph in the final part of this paper, does actually say, well, we could do this. We could do the Laue case. So I think Buchmeller is the person that should really be attributed as the person who came up with this scheme that we're using today. But we tend to attribute Yamashi, who was the guy who did this on a synchrotron first. Another bit of diffraction physics, I promise this is getting somewhere, so just bear with me, is for the Exfil work, we have to consider the fact that the pulse duration is short compared to the time scale for X-ray diffraction through the crystal. And that's relevant because it basically emerges that you have to consider two measures of the what's called the angular spread, I guess, of X-rays transmitted through the crystal. So the way to view this is through this diagram you see on the left-hand side here. If you have light that impinges on the crystal and you scan through the Bragg angle,
and you measure the output light, you end up with something like this here, which is like a transmission curve plot. And conventionally in the field, people have called this both the rocking curve and the Darwin curve. In this work, we define the rocking curve as the actual angular spread of X-rays which can make it through the crystal, whereas the Darwin width would be the predicted angular spread if you use a theory that neglects any sense of time dependence within the crystal. Now, you could use a dynamical simulation to back out exact values for this rocking curve width, but that gets really into the weeds. And so the approach that we take in this work is we assume a transform limited pulse. And in that case here, the products of the XFEL pulse duration and the rocking curve width is equal up to a factor of order unity of this expression here, where lambda is just the wavelength of the X-rays impinging on the crystal. And the reason I've gone through that is effectively because the original theory, which I introduced a couple of slides ago by Yamaji et al., Bukamela et al. Before that, assumes that these two quantities, the rocking curve and the Darwin curve, are the same. And so if we take into account time dependence, we have to modify the axion generation equation, as you see here. And what that ends up doing is introducing this extra factor shown in purple, which amplifies the probability of conversion by something like a factor of 100. So that brilliance number that I talked about before, what that does is it actually amplifies the probability of axion generation compared to the synchrotron case, which is quite nice. So that's kind of the idea in principle. What did it look like in practice? I'm now going to go through some data from our initial runs at the European Free Electron Laser. And the first set of plots I'm going to show you are actually a relatively negative story that we found in the initial hours of that beam time. And this was that maintaining the alignment of that double crystal setup that I showed you was really quite challenging due to the heat load which was imposed on them by the XFEL. And that point is made, I think quite clear by this plot here, which shows the power transmitted through the double crystal setup as a function of time with that shield removed. And what you see is that in time scale on the order of minutes, if you have the full flux of the FEL, you lose alignment and the setup ceases to be sensitive to axions. We did find we were able to maintain stable alignment if we reduce the flux of the crystals by something like a factor on the order of 10 to the 3. But the complications associated with finding that stable operating regime reduce the available search time below that 3 days that we had, which already, frankly, wasn't very long to do this kind of work. And so we limited our search to acquiring data at the Bragg angle and 4 discrete detuning angles. I've got a throwaway comment on this slide saying we can mitigate this in various ways, and I propose active cooling here. That wasn't what we did, but we used a different technique at Sackler. So we'll come back to that towards the end of the talk. So because of this heating, we had to use a multi-step process for data collection where we effectively characterized the transmission through the double crystal setup with the shield out, both crystals detuned to the Bragg angle, then detuned to the search angle, put the radiation shield in, collected some data for somewhere 10 minutes, and then did the whole thing in reverse and got some more characterization data and used this to run by run characterize the efficiency of transmission through the setup. So this is just in the systematics, but it's really explaining in those non-ideal conditions how we're able to continuously monitor the efficiency of this process in order to get a set of bounds out. Now, kind of, I guess the key thing to note is that we didn't observe any events consistent with axion production through the entire beam time. And that point is made with these two plots that you see here. The one on the left-hand side is a histogram, which shows all events that you can associate with photons above 1 kilo electron volt for all the runs where we're looking for axions. And this is compared in black to a dark count, which is just 24 hours of thermal noise of the detector, essentially. And what you see is that these two things match. There's very little signal except maybe in this pedestal here, which you can associate with the FEL at all. On the right-hand side, you see what's called a hit map. So this just shows, as the colored points, any photons which impinged on the region of the detector where we would expect axions to fall. And overlaid on that is what I've called the X-ray spot. So this is effectively just a spot which you see when you tune both crystals to the Bragg angle and you remove the shield. So an event consistent with
Hertzian production should have the same energy as the seed photons, and it should also lie on that X-ray spot. We didn't see any events that are consistent with both of those two criteria during the entire beam time. So based on that null result, we were able to impose 90% confidence interval bounds on the coupling strength. And the way that we did that was effectively, as described in this paper here, assuming Poisson statistics, taking a 90% confidence interval with a mean of zero, which works out as 2.3 detected events per search. And putting that all together, you get the set of bounds that you see here. So just to remind you, this setup is sensitive to axiom masses in two discrete ranges. First of all, we have a broadband range, which is accessed when we tune both crystals to the Bragg angle. And then we have these narrowband ranges that you see here, which are what we get when we detune both crystals the same amount from the Bragg angle. And the X-file result here is compared to a number of different lab detection searches. For this heavy mass range in particular, you can see that there are two accelerator searches, NA64 and VA bar, which were a little more sensitive. Which were a little more sensitive than this initial experiment that we carried out at the European X-file. And I just want to say a few words about those particular experiments in the sense that I really think they're quite complementary to the work that we did. So BA bar is a scheme which involves recasting some bounds on a dark photon experiment to look for axioms. And this is a scheme which is sensitive to spontaneous axiom decay. So you're looking for processes encoded in the Feynman diagrams like the ones you see here. The NA64 experiment, again, it's a beam dump experiment in this case. So you take 100 GeV electrons, and in the NA64 beam dump, you produce axions via the Primakoff effect. And you search again for the signature of spontaneous axion decay and also missing energy in the calorimetry data. And so I guess the point I'm making here is because we directly reconvert to photons in the light shining through a wall scheme, it's really quite a complementary scheme to these two that you see here. In terms of this work, the final comment I want to make is two, three months ago, got back from SACLA in Japan, where we performed a follow-up experiment building directly on the EU X-file configuration. In this setup, we operated passively in air, so we didn't put the crystals in a vacuum, and this increased our background, but it was a deliberate trade-off in the sense that because of the passive cooling, we could increase our photon flux by a factor of, that should say, 10 to the 3, not 10 to the 4, compared to the EU X-file search. In addition to that, we also used thicker germanium samples. So we went to 1.5 millimeters as opposed to the 0.5 millimeter of germanium that we had in the previous search. And taking those two steps together yields a set of bounds that you see here. So again, in pink, we have the SACLA bounds. This is on Bragg. This is off Bragg. There's a zoomed in view of the off-Bragg searches here. And you see that we're really getting quite close to the QCD axiom band in this kind of 3 keV range. And also that in the on-Bragg case, we're able to achieve higher sensitivity than any existing direct detection search in the, let's say, 1 to 10 keV range. So you could improve this in future. You could improve the signal to noise, and that would give you a factor of few in terms of sensitivity. And you could obviously implement a continuous scan of angles within some range, particularly if you are maybe targeting some gap in the cosmological bounds, for example. But it's not going to be significantly better. So that's where I think this setup as it currently stands is going to stand. So that is everything I want to say about X-files. The next little bit of the talk is kind of a change of gear. But I do think the two sections sit pretty well together in the sense that what I just showed you was a scheme to look for axions, so to exploit a particular coupling, which it is quite challenging to access with a conventional research accelerator. But what we saw from the X-file work is that this was actually relatively low-hanging fruit for an X-ray light source. It was a coupling that was not that difficult to access. And I say that in the sense that it's not that we didn't work hard, it's that we're a relatively small team. And we had 3 days of time to set this up and collect all our data. And I think when we move into the next few years with high-powered lasers, perhaps we as a community should be thinking more about ways in which we can exploit couplings that are challenging on accelerators but might represent low-hanging fruit for different drivers. That's the kind of the parallel between the two schemes that I see here. And as a bit of background, I kind of want to motivate this in terms of my own story. The reason that I came to the Rutherford, one of the reasons, was because we are currently engaged in building a new high-powered laser. That's what all the building work behind you is. And this is called Vulcan 2020. It's an optical laser system. So micron light, that's equivalent to about an EV, photon energy. It will deliver 1 petawatt per pulse in a 20 femtosecond length. Has a large aperture, focused down to large aperture initially, but this is focused down to 5 microns, enabling peak intensities on the order of 10 to the 23 watts per centimeter squared. The design explores splitting the beam into equal arms, enabling photon-photon interactions, for example. And the main 20 petawatt beam is also complemented by a 1 petawatt class laser, which is optimized for laser wake field acceleration, which would give you about 1 GeV electrons, and a beam which is temporally synchronized to the optical pulse and also has a comparable size and duration. I think that's probably a motivation for using a wake field here as opposed to a conventional accelerator. So to kind of give it some context in terms of this field of high power laser physics, there are a growing number of petawatt class laser systems worldwide. One that's, I guess, close to some people's hearts here is TAP, which was the laser system that we just decommissioned here at the Rutherford, which I think was the first of these petawatt class lasers, or one of the first. And at the minute, we're kind of pushing the bounds from that sort of petawatt class system to multi-petawatt class systems. And here you can see a plot of planned 10 plus petawatt class lasers. CLF, we're building Vulcan 2020. There's a project called NSF Opal, which is going on in New York State in the US. And there are the various ELI lasers throughout Europe, which are at a higher stage of development compared to both Vulcan and Opal. And here I've just picked some experiments which one might consider exploring with these multi-petawatt lasers. Now, this isn't supposed to be some kind of broad map of the field. I'm not trying to pose some phenomenological model to think what should we try and target. I'm just saying, as an experimentalist, what grabbed my interest. And so you can see here a scheme for stimulated all optical photon scattering involving 3 laser beams. And this is something that Opal, the laser system in the States, is really targeting as part of their science case. Quantum radiation reaction is this one here, which is interesting in the sense that work is being done. So on the Gemini laser system here at the CLF, colleagues from Imperial College used a scheme where they drove fast electrons against a colliding laser to impose bounds on various models of quantum radiation reaction. Axion photon and axion electron coupling, I'm going to talk about that very briefly for a couple of slides before I wrap up. And I'm sure Bob would want me to call out these kind of longer term directions in terms of things like exotic atoms, post-Newtonian gravity, gravitational wave detection. I think the list probably goes on. So as an example of what you might do, this is a scheme which has been proposed to look for axions with optical lasers. It involves 2 orthogonally polarized lasers to generate axions, then a wall, then a 3rd laser to regenerate photons, and projected bounds that are relevant for a multi-petawatt laser in Prague, shown here, but you could adapt this to other laser facilities, including the one that we're building. And also, here's a scheme for axion electron coupling, which basically involves directly accelerating electrons in the electric field of 2 counterpropagating lasers and generating axions by analogy with radiation from accelerated charge. The projected sensitivities you should look at are really actually the blue ones here. That's kind of next generation lasers. The purple is next generation. But you can see, again, even for this next generation of lasers, you're accessing bounds that I think are competitive with accelerator-based or reactor-based in this case, and through a different mechanism again. So there's that multitude of approaches type justification. That is everything I wanted to say. So thanks very much for your attention. And I'd really like any questions if you've got them.
Any questions?
Yeah, so clearly your crystals are giving you bending power, magnetic fields integrated in the short distance, but they are suffering from heating. if somebody lent you a couple of LHC dipoles, how could you do anything?
So the kind of conventional light shining through a wall experiments, you could implement a similar scheme with an X-ray laser. The problem would be locating that length of electromagnet with an X-fill. And I think that's kind of the limitation of this kind of driver, right? They're multi-purpose machines. So you end up with end stations that are designed for, you know, a whole bunch of different jobs, and you get 3 days on it, you get maybe a week on it, maybe 6 weeks if you're lucky. So that does really touch on the limitation of this kind of scheme, is that because you're using multi-purpose machines, that kind of permanent installation is something that's challenging. You'd have to build a whole science case around adding extra end stations and so on, I guess. Thanks for the question.
On that, is it worth putting that case forward for a UK expo and saying, when you build this, or if you build it, we need these stations?
Yeah, and some of this stuff could be quite passive, right? So the UK XL proposal was talking about multiplexed end stations, for example, so you could go to multiple different places at the same time, and you could imagine having this running for a long time in that kind of scheme. Thank you.
Probably not a question for you, I suspect, but maybe for somebody else in the audience. Williams published a paper on the 10th of January arguing that topological features of QCD produce theta bar zero naturally without needing an axion at all. As I've seen no comment on this, I've not published, put it on archive. I've seen no comment from anybody else on this. Nobody knows whether it's reasonable or nonsense.
As far as I'm concerned, whoosh. I'm sorry.
You said there's no need for it, is it?
That's what Williams argued. He said, yes. He said theta bar comes out zero if you take into account topology of QCD, but I couldn't follow it.
Interesting. You could send the paper.
I have a really, really naive question. On the heating of the crystals, and you said you reduced the flux. Is that how are you reducing the flux?
Oh, you just take a bit of silicon in the beam and that attenuates the number of X-rays, so just mass attenuation in the silicon.
Yeah, makes sense.
Can you actively cool the crystals?
Yes. So we actually, in parallel with the SACNA proposal, which was designed to be a relatively easy way of doing it, so just the passive cooling in air is a straightforward modification, we submitted a proposal to EUXFEL to do the same thing with actively cooled crystals. We didn't get anywhere with that particular proposal. I think what it would require is some dedicated synchrotron time, just looking at heating and trying to understand how we can limit that, and we could use that to motivate a bid for X-fell time. But it is ask anyone who works on this kind of machine, the constant kind of driver is really getting time. Those 3 days you really work for, and then you've got to make them count.
You probably said, but what's the physical dimension of these crystals?
So the EUXFEL were half a millimeter thick by centimeter in area.
Okay.
You use a small fraction of that. In terms of the area, you use microns, lots of microns of that.
And what sort of temperature did they get to?
Doesn't take very much. So kind of, I had this in the plot. Try and put it on my back, but here we go. So this is actually the Darwin cut. So in reality, it's even thinner, but this is the angular acceptance of one of these things in a steady state fashion. And you can see we're really talking about a very small fraction of a degree here. So you need to expand your lattice planes by something which is a small fraction of the interatomic spacing before you start to lose this. And so we were looking at significantly less than a Kelvin degree of heating. It's just that was too much already.
So I know we chatted about this a little bit before, yeah. But the European X-fell, because they use that rapid train,
yeah.
And there's a big break and stuff, whereas other X-fells that have that continuous train,
mm-hmm.
Would the heating problem go away? Would that all be better with other X-fells because you have that break, you don't have that rapid
I think the equilibration timescale would be on the order of microseconds to microseconds, roughly. So my guess is that's not something you could access with the bunch structure on different fells is not necessarily relevant to the timescale of the cooling process. But active cooling is, there's a lot of work to be done in terms of active cooling if you want to push it in that way.
So in you showed various limit plots and so on. Mm-hmm. In sort of future mega ambitions, have you got any plots for where one could get to?
I think in that heavy region, realistically, you can probably get halfway down the QCD axiom band. That's without some step change in the way that we do this, that's the limit of the technique. But that doesn't mean, I mean, you saw those couple of papers that I showed you at the end. That's John Luker's group at Oxford really thinking of different ways to do it. So there are people, including John Luker, working on ways to change these setups so you end up with those step changes. But again, this is, I'm looking at axioms to some degree as an observer from this perspective. A lot of these schemes, they have this thing where you have a really nice idea. You can do it for 3 days, you can do it for 3 years. It doesn't hugely, hugely change the picture. It's really just the underlying physics of whatever you're using to make your axioms. So it would, my take is it does have to be a new scheme if you want to go any further than that.
So are you planning to request more beam time at XFL?
I think we are currently working on the paper. So the paper on the Sackler stuff, there's a draft which has just gone out to our co-authors, and we want to see what the reaction for that is. The next thing would be to kind of target a bit of physics that we want to do differently the next time around, and that will be used to motivate a proposal. So maybe 6 months from now, that's what we'll be trying to do, but I don't know if it will be going for sensitivity or going for, you know, the Yamaji paper that was the people who did this on a synchrotron. They scanned continuously in the off brain pace. They got a broadband range of masses. So you might want to do something like that instead, where you go for a broadband in masses. So, you know, not just looking at these little spikes in parameter space, you're looking at a fuller parameter space up to a given sensitivity.
And one question on these kind of experiments. When you said that the model dependence is removed,
mm-hmm.
I was wondering whether you have an estimate of how many signal events eventually you would expect, or how is systematics estimated in those exclusion bands? That's my ignorance.
Well, so for the XFEL, UXFEL experiment, I think systematics were relatively trivial. We had to worry about asystematic, but not in the sense that people usually mean in terms of the changing efficiency of the setup, because we were constantly fiddling with it. But there was we didn't see any background, right? There was not a single photon in the whole beam time that you could associate with axiom production. And that came down to precise time gating. So we gated the detector around the X-ray pulse, and it came down to spatial gating in the sense that we have this spatially resolved detector. And we know where on that detector the photon should end up. And it came down to energy resolution in the sense that because the detector is single photon counting, we can go down to, this was a 10 keV photon, this was a 3 keV photon. So check away the 3 keV photons. And all those things together reduce your systematics very low. For the Sackler experiment, because we were operating in air, the background was higher. And so in Sackler, what we ended up doing was we saw like this uniform distribution of scatter, which made it through the baffles and the flight tube and so on. And we ended up doing an approach where we took a mixed model where we fit a Gaussian to the axion signal and fit a uniform to the scatter. And we took a 90% confidence interval on the amplitude of that Gaussian. Now, we claimed it was a null result in the sense that if we compared the two models through like a Bayes factor, so like a Bayesian analysis to work out which model was better out of just a uniform distribution for scatter versus a uniform distribution with some Gaussian contribution for the axioms. The result of that was that the uniform distribution was a profoundly better fit for the data than the mixed model. So we still claimed it was a null result in that case.
Awesome.
But that's, I mean, we still need to go through that, right? We've just written out the paper. We're going to co-authors now, and I'm sure they will have some comeback on that particular analysis.
And And on the petawatt laser facilities, mm-hmm. What do you think would be the first topic from the fundamental physics research list that you mentioned that is would be most attractive or more easily accessible?
I think this is a controversial statement, and there might be people in the audience who disagree, but the work that Stuart Mangles and son are doing at the minute on Gemini demonstrates a pathway to achieve results that are relevant to the community. So this sort of stuff is useful in the sense that you're getting results that are relevant, but also you're learning about things like the systematics and how they're different. And so for me, going forward, one of the things that I think I'm thinking about is, can you submit proposals that really, even if you don't have particularly competitive bounds, if you're saying, well, we're trying to understand the systematics associated with these optical laser experiments in order to facilitate the design of future facilities or understand how we might improve it, then that's the motivation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think getting more papers out of it and having like a killer experiment will attract also more proposals from our community from particle physics.
Yes, that's a good point. I think certainly in the community for optical lasers, this all optical photon-photon scattering type work is seen as one of the things that would be of the highest impact, but it also, and I'm now speaking as a laser designer rather than a laser user, happens to be one of the most challenging to pull off in terms of the design of your laser.
Yes.
Can I ask a silly question? When you said you measured no events, which were an accident, suppose you'd seen what? I'm thinking here of, what was it called, the Kensington event, where they found a charge of a third of an electron charge, and nobody knew what to do about it. Suppose if you saw one.
If you saw one, I mean, and this is, for me, coming from a field where null results are not the norm, that's something which I feel a bit uncomfortable about. In reality, what you do is you claim that it was a null result, and you stick your Poisson distribution with a mean of one rather than a mean of zero, and take your 90% confidence interval. But I share your... you didn't say it, but I am uncomfortable about that kind of thought process.
Mm-hmm. It's a good argument for more beam time.
That's what I was expecting to say.
if you got a bunch, you know, not just a single event, but a bunch which were, you know, if you started sitting on what you thought might be meaningful, so you were saying, oh, this is one sigma, can we push it to three sigma? Then very often, that's how you motivate more time with a lot of these things, right? Like me and Bob and others are grappling with this from the other perspective, in the sense, we want to access an end station as an accelerator where there's currently a dark matter experiment that's saying, well, we've got three sigma, we might be able to push it to four.
I'm not sure I've fully understood, like, how you can, like, rule this stuff out, like, definitively. If you do an experiment for just 3 days,
mm-hmm.
is the probability of this reaction high enough? You can be like, right, there's definitely nothing there. Like, if you then ran your experiment for like 5 weeks continuously.
Well, I mean, practically, what that we're not saying there's nothing there. We're saying the probability of an interaction is less than something if accident exists, right? So, what that would mean is if we ran it for 5 weeks, then we would shift that down a bit.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So you're making bounds on the probability.
Yeah, exactly.
So, right. Well.
This is off the topic, but just to mention, there was a workshop a few weeks ago on other options if the FCC is unaffordable. And there was a really exciting session there with Tim Barclay and others. I mean, it's been the Lane Wakefield acceleration, it's a sort of long-term thing, and the real problem with that has been that it looks very promising for accelerating electrons, but positrons much harder.
Mm-hmm.
And it all came together with a session where Tim Barclay was kind of running the show and so on, and where Emilio Nani and this girl who's recently come to CERN from Berkeley, I forgot her name, the idea is that you have two electron accelerators, and then you do it as a gamma-gamma collider, and you
maybe have
to reach a 10 TeV gamma-gamma collider, no worrying about positrons, and it just looks beautiful. I was mm-hmm. really impressed mm-hmm. with it. I'm
questions for that comment. So I don't see more questions in the room, but we are going to have a lunch with Jack. So please join me if you have more questions to discuss. So thank you very much again for the panel. Okay, for people on Zoom, we close the seminar. Thank you.
No,